Now, on July the 4th, America will celebrate its 250th birthday. And over the coming months, we'll be marking this anniversary by speaking with some of the country's leading scholars. Now, as something of a curtain raiser, I've been talking with Marianne Williamson. Twice she ran for the Democratic presidential nomination in 2020 and 2024, and she rose to national prominence back in the 1980s as a spiritual leader and the author of the New York Times bestseller, A Return to Love. I've known Marianne for about 15 years, long before she entered politics. We've been talking about and debating US history ever since. She's been here on a speaking tour, and we caught up for a chat. Marianne Williamson, thanks so much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Thank you so much for having me.
Marianne, we're approaching the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, the foundational moment of the United States of America. But has that very term become an oxymoron? Are there now two Americas, mutually antagonistic tribes occupying the same continent, with people who have very different views about what their country should be and what their country should stand for?
Well, the ideal, of course, is that, first of all, there are 50 states, not two. And the ideal was that we would be different ethnicities, different cultures, different politics, different ways of seeing things, but that we would be united by our fealty to a common set of principles, namely those principles in the Declaration of Independence. And that is what's fallen apart in the last few years, and that's why we're in trouble.
Tell me where Donald Trump came from, in your view. I remember meeting you 15 years ago. Very different sense of America back then. What has happened in that time that has brought America to this point?
Well, Donald Trump is a symptom. Donald Trump is, I think, in many ways, an inevitable result of a breakdown which arguably began around 60 years ago. First of all, in the last 50 years, there's been a $50 trillion transfer of wealth into the hands of a very, very few Americans. The ideal was that the government would be the broker between forces of individual liberty, which certainly includes economic liberty, and a concern for the common good, so that there was to be this brokering between public and private concerns. Starting certainly with Ronald Reagan, the focus became so intense on behalf of those who represented private power, private wealth, that it was very much at the expense of the public good. Now, definitely a Republican president started this, but no Democrat stopped it. It became the complete corporatization, really, of the political elite of the United States, and corporate power overrode the interests of the people. Rather than Lincoln's phrase, of the people, by the people, and for the people, we became a government of the corporations of the very, very wealthy and for the corporations and the very, very wealthy. Now, the economic despair, the chronic economic despair that this produced, part of what's so tragic to me is that this was entirely preventable. All of this was entirely preventable and would have been if people had exercised even the most rudimentary recognition of world history. Whenever you have large groups of desperate people, you know, you can even see this, you don't have to go back to the French Revolution. You can go back to Germany after World War I. What made the people, an economically crushed people, were so vulnerable to the machinations of Adolf Hitler. When you have large groups of desperate people, it becomes a kind of social petri dish out of which inevitably emerges some level of societal dysfunction, which includes two things that the United States now sees represented by Donald Trump. Number one, attraction to a political strongman. I'm the only one who can fix it. I can fix it. And number two, capture, ideological capture by genuinely psychotic forces, and that we certainly see in America today.
So you would primarily see his rise and the political polarization that you see in America as a product of income polarization, these widening disparities of wealth?
Well, I think that that's at the bottom of it, because I think that people living with chronic economic despair become vulnerable in ways that others do not. And certainly there's a multidimensional problem on our hands because it's an all systems breakdown. But I think to deny that factor is to fail to recognize a central cancer. The undue influence of money on our politics, I do believe, is the cancer that underlies all the other cancers. Remember, we don't have universal health care. We're the only advanced nation that doesn't. We don't have universal health care. We have 70 to 90 million people who are, if not uninsured, underinsured. We have over 1 million people who ration their insulin. We don't have tuition-free college or tech school. It's very difficult to get a higher education unless you are among these privileged classes that have grown up in the last 50 years in America. The unbelievable billionaire class, I mean, it's grotesque. And how anybody could have thought that this was in any way sustainable is rather amazing, actually.
Donald Trump has won two presidential elections. The first time it was seen as something of an aberration, a sort of glitch in the operating system. You know, he didn't win the nationwide popular vote. He won the Electoral College. That was enough to get into the White House under the U.S. Constitution. No dispute about that. In 2024, he won a more emphatic election victory, the first Republican in 20 years to win the nationwide popular vote. That would suggest he's more representative of America than a lot of people would care to think.
Well, I'm not enrolled in your first premise. I know that's the standard elite status quo belief. That was just a glitch in the system. I didn't see it as a glitch in the system.
I didn't either.
Then.
But
that is
the argument.
Yeah, sure. I think in what happened in 2016 is that two people said to the American people, your rage is understandable, it is valid, you're being screwed by the system, and you have every right to be pissed. Two people said that, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders.
Hmm. Flip side of the same coin?
No, not at all. One of them meant it and one didn't. Simple as that. Hmm. But because the Democratic Party bosses and the Democratic elite in the party suppressed the voice of Bernie, literally, put their fingers on the scale so there had to be Hillary, not only did the polls at that time show that Bernie would win, but the democratic process would require that the political party keep its hands off the scales until the people themselves, the voters, have decided. If they had done that, I don't know if Bernie or Hillary would have won that primary in 16, but I don't think Trump would have been president, because I think that the Democrats wouldn't have been so grumpy about the whole thing.
It's interesting you raise Bernie Sanders, because an orthodoxy has taken hold in the Democratic Party, which frankly is backed up by history, that you need to be a centrist to win the presidency. You know, John F. Kennedy wasn't a champion of liberalism. He was a very pragmatic, hard-nosed politician. Lyndon Johnson, another Democratic president. Jimmy Carter, another Democrat from the conservative side of the Democratic Party, a Southern Democrat. Bill Clinton, likewise, a Southern Democrat who was very moderate, prided himself in his centrism. Barack Obama, too. You know, in his campaign in 2008, he praised Ronald Reagan. Bernie Sanders comes from a very different tradition in the Democratic Party, a more radical tradition. Are you saying that the orthodoxy that Democrats have always had, which you need to be a centrist to win the presidency, no longer holds?
I am absolutely saying that. Number one, it's an ahistoric moment. Number two, I remember in my own lifetime when Ronald Reagan was considered too conservative to ever become president. The Republican Party would never let that slow them down. The Republican Party would never say, well, maybe we need to be more like the Democrats to win. Number two, all of those times that you're talking about, JFK, et cetera, there was not this bubbling rage and anger among the majority of Americans who were being so screwed by the economics of the time. So the people who decided what you just said have hardly left the Hamptons. They've hardly left Sun Valley. They've hardly left Georgetown. They have no idea. They had no idea.
These are elite enclaves for the people who don't know.
Thank you.
You're listening to ABC Radio National with me, Nick Bryant, and I'm talking with Marianne Williamson, who twice ran for the Democratic presidential nomination, first of all in 2020 and next in 2024. Let's talk about the Democratic Party. I often get asked this question. Why has their resistance been so feeble during Trump 2.0? It's a criticism you hear a lot.
Well, there are two aspects of political formulation. One is you put strategy first. One is you put principles first. If you base your strategy on your principles, you're never feeble because you stand on your principles no matter what, and your strategy fits into that. The Democratic Party forgot its own principles. Look what happened in 2024 and also in 2016 with Bernie. The Democratic Party should be democratic. It shouldn't be this top-down thing where a few party bosses, you know, decide who the nominee is going to be. But there was this strategy that we know best, the strategy that we're going to put Hillary up, or the strategy that we're going to make sure that it's Biden again. That means you're not aligned with your own passion. You're not aligned with your own gut. So the Democrats so deviated in the last few decades from the traditional values of the Democratic Party. And once you do that, you leak your passionate communication, and then you contribute to that. You add to that the Citizens United decision and the fact that so much corporate power and corporate lobbying was determining our policies. And how do you really defend that and expect to win a Democratic election?
The criticism of the Democratic Party in many quarters is that it became too woke, that there was an absolutism on the left, that cancel culture had just got too censorious. Identity politics had become too extreme. Was that a problem, do you think?
Well, I do think that that's a big problem, but I don't see it as a problem so much for the Democratic Party, except that the Democratic Party was too often seen that way. I don't think it actually had a major influence on the party policies themselves. But yeah, there's an obnoxious quality to that, number one. An arrogant, self-righteous left-winger is no less obnoxious than an arrogant, self-righteous right-winger. So nobody likes that. Everybody's turned off by it. It's very condescending. It's very patronizing. But no, I don't think that that was a poison within the Democratic Party. I think that was a small poison within the Democratic Party.
That's interesting, Marianne, because listeners will think you sounded left-wing on economic issues, but on those cultural issues, not so.
That's correct, actually. I agree with President Eisenhower, who said that the American mind at its best is both liberal and conservative.
Hmm.
Radical left and radical right are somewhat problematical in America today. And I think of myself as pretty far left, but there's a far, far, far left in America today that is a whole different story.
We're approaching the midterm elections in November. History would suggest that the Democrats will regain control, at least of the House of Representatives. They face a tougher map in the Senate. Do you see a blue wave sweeping over the country?
Once again, you refer to history. This is an ahistoric moment. We've never had a tyrant in the office the way we do now. We never have someone actively, proactively trying to rig the elections already like we do now. So absolutely, if the elections were today, and I think this would be true in November as well, and they were free and fair elections, I have no doubt that the Democrats would do a major sweep. The majority of Americans see through this man. They understand what's happening. However, we are living in a very, very dangerous moment for our democracy when he is already through identification laws. It's so interesting. Now he's saying, well, even if they don't pass a law, we're going to make sure it happens. Kristi Noem saying only the right people will vote. Steve Bannon saying damn well we'll have ICE agents outside the polls. What, armed thugs outside the polls? We're really skating on very, very thin ice here. The will of the people may or may not have the final say in November, depending on how successful the president's administration will be at rigging the election.
Marianne Williamson, one of the questions that I get asked a lot is whether America is heading towards civil war, not just flashpoints like we've seen recently in Minneapolis, but something bigger on a nationwide scale. Do you share that fear?
Well, there's such a thing as a Cold War, and I think we're already in it.
Mm.
However, when you look at something like a civil war, it was the North versus the South. You know, one side wore one costume, the other, and had one flag. One side wore another costume. What would a civil war even look like other than a bloodbath in America today? So a conscious, decent, patriotic American must be absolutely committed to a real civil war not happening in the United States.
When I get asked that question, my stock response is, I don't think America is inexorably heading towards civil war, but I don't see it living in a state of civil peace. I think you're more optimistic on that front.
Well, we're not living in a state of peace. And what you just said is you see it happening. I think it's already happening. This, you know, Martin Luther King said that there's a negative peace and positive peace. Negative peace, he said, is where there's no outright violence, although arguably there already is with the killing of Rene Goode and Alex Preddy. He said there's no outright violence, but there's an underlying tension and anxiety. There is very much so an underlying tension and anxiety, and worse, a profound toxicity. There's an unsustainable level of agita and anger in the United States today. Martin Luther King said positive peace can only be predicated on brotherhood and justice. And that's what we need now. You know, conviction is a force multiplier. Those who hate, including those who, for their usually for their own economic purposes, partly you have the Peter Thiels, the Elon Musks, you have the billionaire class that has really quite open about it. They find democracy itself inconvenient to their economic purposes. Then you have the white supremacists, and then you have the Christian nationalists. I mean, it's a trio there. It's an axis of undemocratic perspective. They are very committed and they are very convicted. If you have 10 people like that who will spend all day, every day, trying to effectuate their worldview, and then you have 100 people who believe in democracy but kind of, sort of, and I'll show up on Tuesdays and Thursdays, then the people who are assaulting our democracy will win. So what's happening right now is that you're having a major awakening in America. You know, Winston Churchill said you can always count on Americans to do the right thing after they have exhausted every other option. We are often late. We were late in World War II. We're amused and distracted by less meaningful things. But when we wake up, man, we slam it like nobody's business. And that is what I believe was demonstrated by the people on the streets in Minneapolis. It's being demonstrated by some of these judges. I think the people in Minneapolis, even though Tom Homan now says there's going to be increased ICE enforcement over the next year. A template has now been created. And if he takes that show on the road to other cities, which he clearly plans to do, the people of Minneapolis have already created a template, and it will be replicated elsewhere.
You mentioned Martin Luther King. He used to talk about redeeming the soul of America. So much of your life is focused on the spiritual. So much of your life is focused on the soul. You really believe that awakening is in the offing, that coming together is a possibility?
You know, my father once told me, he said, Jews don't believe in miracles, but we rely upon them. You don't have to believe in miracles to look at the history of the United States and see how often the impossible, in fact, occurred. That has to do with the Revolutionary War. It has to do with the Civil War. It has to do with our part in helping to defeat the Nazis. It has to do with women's suffrage. It has to do with civil rights movement. Huge forces were arrayed against the idea that justice could prevail. This is simply the next time that it's come around. And in all of those cases, in the case of abolition, in the case of women's suffrage, and in the case of civil rights movement, they emerged from religious and spiritual circles. The abolitionist movement among white Americans came from the early evangelical churches in New Hampshire. Women's suffrage leaders, many of them were very religious Quakers. And Dr. King, don't forget, he was a Baptist preacher. So there's something that comes with a religious or a spiritual dedication, which is that it doesn't even matter if it happens in my lifetime. Even if all it means is that I die trying, it will give my life meaning to stand for what I know is true in my heart.
Marianne Williamson, thank you so much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Thank you.
That was Marianne Williamson, a former candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination and a best-selling author. She has been in Australia this week.
Think bigger about the world we live in. Ask your smart speaker to play ABC RN.